In the name of God, most gracious, most compassionate. Thank you very much for coming here today. And as it was mentioned in the introduction, I will present to you some of Rumi's teachings about inner perfection and more accurately the requirements for inner perfection. Rumi is arguably one of the most well-known mystics ever lived in the world, and his name is mostly associated with love. So typically whenever we think of Rumi, we always think about love. He actually himself once said that the religion that I follow is the religion of love. Some people who are newcomers to Rumi are really fascinated by his love poetry. But Rumi has a lot more to offer in terms of spiritual growth and development. And tonight's talk is really geared for those who really aspire to follow the footsteps of Rumi in order to see what he used to see, to appreciate what he used to appreciate. So this is really what the intended audience of this presentation is. This is really geared for people who really aspire to follow Rumi's footstep in their spiritual journey. But before we get there, so that we are all on the same page and we break the ice, so to speak, I want to see a show of hands. How many of you have seen the movie Aliens, starring Sigourney Weaver? Okay, good. Do you remember the plot in that movie? The plot basically was the following. Aliens wanted to invade planet Earth, and they knew that if they come in with their odd-looking faces, humans would get together and fight against them. So what they decided to do is to find a way to implant themselves inside human beings. Do you see what the plot is leading to? So they will look like humans. They were strangers, aliens, they would look like human beings. So they will integrate completely with each human individual, but use the body of the human person to basically achieve their own interests and agenda. Right? So this is the plot of our lives as well, as Rumi would tell you. That a lot of times, strangers penetrate us, implant themselves inside us, they take over our self, and then they use us to achieve their ends. And by the way, politicians do exactly the same as well, right? And when we all march on to wars, for example, and we have no clue whatsoever who we are fighting, but we really fight hard. Most of the wars ever fought in history, by the way, were amongst people who really didn't have any qualms with each other. They were doing the dirty work. And people who were sitting on the sidelines encouraging them to go to fight basically reap the benefits at the end. So Rumi basically talks about this plot as well, that there are strangers in this world, and we, if we let them come inside us and they take over us, then we're going to serve them, not ourselves. With this short introduction, so that at least you have a mental picture of what I'm going to be really talking about today. One of the central concepts in mysticism is what Muslim mystics call muraqabah in Farsi and Arabic. Muraqabah. Now, if you want to translate muraqabah into English, it's going to be a little bit difficult. It's going to be something like constant attention and scrutiny. Constant attention and scrutiny. Imagine that you have something really, really valuable. Something that has to do with your well-being and your survival. So that thing will become the focus of your attention. You always look at it. You scrutinize. Am I really serving that purpose? Am I helping myself? So that's what muraqabah means. It means constant attention and scrutiny. The question is, constant attention to what? What is it that we are supposed to be really scrutinizing, put it under microscope all the time? Rumi would respond, yourself, S-E-L-F, yourself. So muraqabah essentially means paying constant attention to yourself. Now this attention to self is the cornerstone of the mystical lifestyle. It doesn't matter whether you embrace the mystic lifestyle in Islam, Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, it doesn't matter. The mystic lifestyle rests on the notion of constant attention to self, which we call muraqabah, and tonight's presentation basically is about that, constant attention to self. By the way, my presentation tonight is theology neutral. Right, so if you are a Jew, Muslim, Christian, Buddhist, you name it, this presentation should be of value to you. I'm going to make a few references to the Muslim holy book, the Quran, but rest assured that you can find exactly the same kind of ideas and references to whatever holy book and sacred book that you subscribe to. So these are general universal truths. But we have to start somewhere, and so I'm going to just use examples from the Quran in two or three cases. But mostly it's about Rumi's teaching. And again, it's theology neutral. So with this short introduction, let me now talk about this idea of muraqabah. You see, in his masterpiece Mathnavi, which spans six volumes, by the way, Rumi really tries very hard to remind us that we all suffer from something I would call MAS. M-A-S. That's my jargon, by the way. Rumi had nothing to do with that. You know what MAS, M-A-S stands for? Misplaced Attention Syndrome. How's that for an acronym, huh? Misplaced Attention Syndrome. This mass, I believe, is one of the root causes of our fundamental unhappiness. Most of us want to be happy, and we always ponder, how can we be happy? Rumi would tell you, first you need to understand what are the impediments to happiness. Once you figure out what those impediments are, you're going to have an easier time attaining happiness. So what does mass, misplaced attention syndrome, as I would call it, really mean? Basically, it means that our eyes, our attention, are always set primarily on the outside. Right? So we constantly focus on the things that are outside ourselves. And unfortunately, I have to admit, our materialistic way of life in modern times exacerbates this problem. That's what we basically, from early childhood, from the time we are toddlers on, that's what we are conditioned to do. We always look outside. It doesn't have to be this way. It doesn't have to be this way. But just in most societies, in modern times, this is happening more and more. We tend to focus on the outside. We spend most of our time, most of our energies, most of our resources to embellish and decorate the outside. Let me give you some examples. We spend most of our energies decorating and embellishing our house, our cars, our professional career. Things that typically are not truly part of us. Right? That's what we do, day in and day out. And since we live in a consumer-based society, this problem gets exacerbated. Because we are under the illusion that luxurious and conspicuous consumption ultimately will lead to happiness and fulfillment in life. That's what materialism as a philosophy, as a way of life, basically preaches. In a nutshell, if I were to tell you what materialism is, that's what it is. Is that somehow you will always associate happiness or your sense of value with the things that you possess, with what basically resides outside you. That's why we often confuse home with a big house on top of a hill. That home is far more than mortar and bricks, right? We tend to confuse friendship with the countless people that we meet in parties and also in our professional career. We think that a better job, a luxury car, high-end furniture and appliances, fashionable clothing, ultimately will translate into a better me. We often define ourselves in terms of stuff, in terms of gadgets, things that are external to us. I guess really Rumi has captured the fundamental problem that we have. So what I'm going to say, by the way, the poetry I'm going to always recite in the original language, Farsi, for those of you who know Farsi, and then I will translate it into English. And all of the translation that I use today are from Nicholson. So here is what Rumi sees as the crux of the problem that we face. صد هزاران فضل داند از علوم جان خود را می نداند آن ظلوم داند او خاصیت هر جوهری در بیان جوهر خود چون خری. This is the story of our lives, unfortunately. And this is the translation. He, and this he can be any of us, he knows 100,000 superfluous matters connected with the various sciences, but that unjust man doesn't know his own soul. He knows the special properties of every substance, but in elucidating his own substance, he is as ignorant as an ass. Well, put it differently. We go to college, we study astrophysics, and then we have a PhD in astrophysics, which basically means, by definition, you know the whole gamut from small subatomic particles all the way to the galaxies and in between. We know all of that, but we don't know who we are. So that's what the problem is, really. That's what looking constantly at outside will get you. Yet you will become very learned. You can become a scholar in what goes on outside you. But then at the same time, we can be as ignorant as an ass when it comes to knowing who we are. So this is really our predicament. This is why, by the way, I think we look awkward. As human beings, especially in modern times, we are out of shape. I don't mean physically. I mean existentially, we are out of shape. We look awkward. We are typically very rich outside, but poor inside. So external richness typically is coupled with internal poverty. That is our plight. And that's what Rumi time and again tries to remind us in his masterpiece. We all intuitively know that we should seek wealth. The problem is we don't know where to seek it. Rumi has a famous saying in Mathnavi which basically says exactly the same thing about external richness and internal poverty. It's just so eloquent, so beautiful. مخزن او دارد که مخزن ذات اوست. هستی او دارد که با هستی ادوست. One has treasure whom treasure is his essence. One has treasure whom treasure is his essence. One is truly living who negates the superficial life. So if you want to attain true and real life, you need to negate superficial life. This is the core teaching of all authentic religions, all authentic spiritual traditions. It doesn't matter where you come across, you know, an authentic spiritual tradition. This teaching will be there awaiting you. right? There are two kinds of treasures: apparent and latent, external and internal. And as Rumi sees it, a truly rich person is going to be rich inside. Now, the problem again is that in our materialistic world, we do not invest our most valuable asset, our time, our life, on things that truly matter to us. Remember the movie Aliens? Throughout the presentation, have that movie in mind. Who are you serving? Are you serving your true needs or aliens and strangers? Now, Rumi tells the story of Jesus in Book 2 of Mathnavi, which again illuminates on the point that I'm trying to make here. That we often focus on things that are absolutely irrelevant to our happiness and our fulfillment in life. Absolutely irrelevant. Rumi says that Jesus was traveling with a companion. They came across a ditch, and there were a few bones in this ditch. The companion told Jesus that you have the power to resurrect the dead. Teach me that exalted name by which you bring the dead back to life. Teach it to me that I may do good and by means of it endow the bones with life. Are you with me what he's trying to say? So this guy, this companion, ask Jesus that teach me the exalted name that you pronounce on the dead and the dead comes back to life. Because I really want to bring these, you know, dead people back to life. Jesus said to this guy, listen man, uttering the exalted name doesn't do magic by itself. There has to be an exalted breath, a pure soul behind it as well. Just, you know, the exalted name is not going to do you any good whatsoever. The problem is, you do not have that exalted breath, that pure heart, pure soul. You don't have it. But that guy wasn't giving up. He kept insisting. At the end, the companion told Jesus, well, if I don't have the exalted breath, I don't have the pure soul that you have, why don't you pronounce the exalted name on these bones so that they come back to life? Jesus was clearly baffled by the insistence of this guy. Jesus turned to God and cried. گفت عیسی یا رب این اسرار چیست؟ میل این ابله در این کار چیست؟ Jesus cried, O Lord, what are these hidden purposes of you? What is the meaning of this fool's inclination to engage in this fruitless work? This is fruitless. Why is it so important for you that these dead people come to life? And now Rumi drops the bombshell on us. مرده خود را رها کرده است او. مرده بیگانه را جوید رفو. He has left uncared for his own dead soul, but seeks to revive the dead bones of a stranger. In other words, he was saying, this idiot, this fool, is a dead man walking. He is devoid of real and meaningful life. He doesn't say, Jesus, use your divine breath, your divine powers to revive me, to enrich my soul, to breathe life into my soul. But he is very eager to revive the dead of strangers. Isn't this our predicament in life? Isn't this what we do day in and day out? This is the crux of the problem I'm trying to get at. Do you remember a mass misplaced attention syndrome? That's the problem. So we all tend to have misplaced priorities. We have undue attention on the things that really will not make us happier, will not enrich our soul, will not really enhance our humanity. The modern way of life, again, is centered on the outside, on consumerism and luxury. It calls for progress. Isn't that what modern life preaches? Progress. What does progress mean? Anybody, what does progress mean? When you're told in your sociology class, you know, that we need to really seek progress. We all know, what, okay, go ahead.
Looking ahead, moving forward.
In enhancing what though? Moving forward in what? It basically, in a nutshell, it means growth in material well-being. That's what progress is all about. Growth in material well-being. All authentic religions, all authentic spiritual traditions, on the other hand, call for perfection. Perfection. Perfection means inner growth and inner progress. So in other words, the focus is different. That's why a lot of spiritual folks in modern times feel out of place. Why? Because the focus is different. The focus is different. Here is the issue though. Inner perfection means accumulating wealth, not just outside, but also inside us. It means enriching not just our pockets, but our soul as well. It means beautifying not just our face, but beautifying our character, personality as well. That's what perfection is all about. Now, here is the catch though. If we want to attain perfection, or in Farsi and Arabic, we call this kamal. If you want to attain perfection, you have to pay a price. There is nothing free in this world. There is a prerequisite, a requirement for inner perfection. Do you know what it is? To have our undivided attention on the inside. You have to have your undivided attention on what goes on inside you. You have to really monitor your inner life. This is what muraqabah is all about. So, once you have muraqabah, once you have this way of looking at the world, in other words, looking at yourself, you will definitely not serve strangers anymore. Muraqabah means that I shall constantly monitor my actions, my words, my thoughts, and oh yes, my intentions. I should always put my thoughts, actions, motives, my intention under the microscope. I should get the most powerful magnifying glass that money can buy. But don't put the magnifying glass on people around you. Put it squarely on yourself. We tend to do the other way around, right? We buy a magnifying glass and always we look at our neighbor. People around us. We never turn the magnifying glass and look at ourselves. Now, muraqabah means doing exactly that. Magnifying, put your internal affairs, so to speak, your internal house under the microscope. This is the requirement for inner perfection. Make no mistake about it. If you want to really attain inner perfection, if you want to make long strides toward the divine, if you want to be spiritually vibrant, you must really pay attention to this requirement. There is a verse in the Holy Quran that I'm going to recite here, which I think offers a great perspective on this issue, and it's going to be really the foundation for the rest of what I have to share with you today. It's in chapter 17, verse 36, an absolutely beautiful verse. And again, I'm sure you can find exactly the same insight in whatever sacred book you subscribe to. وَلَا تَقْفُ مَا لَيْسَ لَكَ بِهِ إِلْمٍ. inna sam'a wal basara wal fu'ad kullu ulaika kanu anhu mas'ula. Do not follow blindly what you do not know to be true. For surely ears, eyes and the heart all shall be questioned of. Do not follow blindly things that you do not know are true, because your eyes, ears and the heart ultimately are responsible. In other words, when will we serve aliens? When our eyes, our ears and our heart are not well managed, when they are not scrutinized. In other words, when we do not pay attention to the traffic that goes in and out of us through our eyes, ears, mouth, our heart, so on and so forth. In mystical literature, we are advised that we should hire guards. You know, we always hire guards to watch over our property, watch over our, you know, hard-earned dollars that we put in banks. Isn't that what we do? Rumi will tell you that you are basically hiring guards for the wrong purpose. You need to hire guards and have those guards watch over your eyes, your ears, your mouth, your heart, basically over your five senses. Are you with me? If you fail to do that, you're going to be miserable in your life. That's the crux of our unhappiness. We are all unhappy. We don't know why. Because a lot of garbage ends up being inside us. Because we do not manage our five senses properly. That's we're going to end up with all kind of issues. Let me briefly talk about this idea of hiring guards and putting them on our eyes, ears, heart, so on and so forth. Very briefly, I mean, the Rumi's work is full of insight and advice on this issue, but since we have very limited time, I'm going to just give you a brief introduction of what Rumi has in mind when he says that you really have to hire guards and appoint them over your five senses. Guarding our eyes. Remember, this lecture is really intended for people who are serious about spiritual growth and development. Our eyes are important channels of contact with the outside world. All sorts of things come inside us through our eyes. Do not think for a second that what you lay your eyes on would not impact your inner state. Let me repeat what I just said. Do not think that what you lay eyes on would not impact ultimately in some way or form your inner state. Whatever you see will ultimately leave a mark on your soul, on your thoughts, and over your psyche. As Rumi would say it, not all the scenes in the outside world are worthy of seeing. Just because they are free, it doesn't mean that you should lay eyes on. Right? So that's the great insight he has. The person who is serious about the spiritual development must pay attention to what she looks at day in and day out. A lot of the things, a lot of the affairs in the outside world, I submit to you, are indeed vulgar. They are vulgar. When we get used to seeing them on a daily basis, they end up vulgarizing our aspirations, our motives, our values, and the very content of our character. So if that's what you're accustomed to seeing day in and day out, what comes in will impact your worldview, your aspirations, your motives, and your ideals. Rumi obviously made great strides in his spiritual journey. Through that journey, he ultimately was able to encounter the divine. Now, when Rumi found himself in the presence of the divine, he would say the following: کاش کی از غیر تو آگه نبودی جان من کاش کی از غیر تو آگه نبودی جان من خود ندانستی به جز تو جان معنی دان من غیر رویت هرچه بینم نور چشمم کم شود هر کسی را رحمت ای پرده مژگان من. You can't say it in any more beautifully than that. And here is the translation. I wish my soul was aware of none but you. Again, he's talking to the divine. I wish my soul was aware of none but you. Thereby, I wouldn't know of anyone but you. Whatever I see beside your face dims my eyesight. Whatever I see beside your face dims my eyesight. Oh, my eyelids, do not let everyone in. هر کسی را رحمت ای پرده مژگان من. Oh, my eyelids, do not just let anybody and everybody in. You see, these eyes were given to us in order to seek beauty in life, not garbage. Right? That's what basically Rumi is trying to teach us. If you hope to someday be able to see the beauty of the divine, you got to train your eyes to only seek out the beauty in this world, not just everything that come across you. I submit to you that a great deal of what we see every day on TV, on the internet, and in movies are indeed vulgar. And unfortunately, once we consume these, once we get used to consuming this kind of nonsense, it will impact us in all sorts of ways. They will impact our aspirations, our ideals, the sense of who we are. So, Rumi's message to us is be vigilant of what you see on a regular basis because they are habit forming. That's how habits are formed. Guarding our ears. Our ears are obviously very important as well in getting information and insights from the outside world. We also need to hire a guard and put it at our ears to control the traffic that comes in. Not all talks are worthy of listening. What do every day when we get into our car? Just turn the radio on, we start driving. We never really scrutinize what is it that we are listening to. Ask yourself, does this discussion on TV, this talk show on radio, this talk at the party, does it really awaken the goodness in me or not? Does this talk make me a better person? Does this talk make me a more loving, a kinder, more compassionate person? Does this talk make me God aware? And I submit to you that most of what we listen to and hear every day does not pass muster. That's the problem that we have. Now, in the Holy Quran, one of the characteristics of the residents of heaven is the following. It said, لا تسمع فيها لاغية. In heaven, in a garden on high, where they shall hear no word of vanity. You see, heaven is a place where the residents do not listen, do not hear words of vanity, no idle talk. And I submit to you, most of what we hear every day, most of what we listen to, are nothing but idle talk. So we need to be very careful. in parties, when we go to, always ask this question: would this discussion, would this talk help me become a better person? In any way, shape or form, you get the sense that this talk is going to basically resurrect the evil in you, make you basically become more suspicious of everybody else, less kind, less gentle, less compassionate. By all means, do yourself a service. Get out. That's what Rumi would invite you to do. Guarding our tongue. You see, our tongue can cause all sorts of problems for us. And let me give you a sampling of the problems that the tongue can cause for us. You see, tongue is a means of communicating with the outside world. Our tongue transports what is inside us to the outside world. One of the functions of the tongue is to reveal what is hidden, what is hidden inside. Our thoughts, our desires, our intentions are basically transported to the outside world through our tongue. Basically, our tongue will tell the world who we truly are inside us. You see, we can spend a bundle masquerading ourselves. And we do it every day, right? We spend a lot of money masquerading ourselves. We wear expensive jewelry. We wear expensive clothing so that they mask from the outside world who we truly are. This mask can become very effective until we start talking. We wear pricey perfume, we wear pricey fragrance to smell great. But as soon as we open our mouth to talk, as Rumi would say, the stench within pours out in our words. Rumi has the following to offer. A great insight. مشک را بر تن مزن بر دل بمال مشک را بر تن مزن بر دل بمال مشک چه بود نام پاک ذوالجلال. Do not put the musk on your body but rub it on your heart. What is musk? The holy name of the glorious God. In other words, it is not just good enough to smell good, you know, outside. But we should also smell good inside. Our thoughts must be fragrant as well. Our intentions must be fragrant as well. Our characters must be fragrant as well. But that's not what we do though. We only focus on smelling good, and that's what we do with all the money that we have to spend on. So this is one way that actually our tongue can cause trouble for us, revealing who we truly are. Now there is another way that our tongue can cause other sorts of problems. The words that we use, we enter into a dialogue with the outside world. You know what the problem is? As soon as you utter words, the words that you utter will basically elicit a response from the outside world. You say something and you know the person who is listening to you will respond accordingly. So basically the words that we utter create a process with the outside world. It creates a space. This space that we create with the words that we utter can be positive, which means we can create a very peaceful environment for ourselves and everybody else. But it can also be negative. We can create a confrontational, stressful, and hostile environment with the words that we utter. There is another dialogue that we need to pay attention to, but we don't have enough time for me to spend on it. we also have a dialogue typically with ourselves, an inner dialogue. We all talk to ourselves. Sometimes we talk to ourselves loudly. I'm driving in my car and I'm talking to myself, and the guy in the next car says, this guy is nuts, he's a lunatic, he's talking to himself. Well, there's nothing wrong with it, we all do it. Sometimes we talk loudly, but sometimes we talk silently with ourselves. This inner dialogue that we have is extremely crucial for our well-being. Watch what you say to yourself day in and day out. If the tone of this inner dialogue is negative, it will impact your thoughts, your actions, and your motives. In other words, if you constantly remind yourself of what you lack in your life, it will make you miserable. If you constantly dwell on the negatives, that will impact you as well. So be very cognizant of this inner dialogue that you have. And this is the subject for another presentation, but just food for thought. So we need to hire a guard and watch over our tongue, both in terms of the dialogue we have with the outside world and also the inner dialogue we have. And I serve the best for the last, guarding over our heart. This is so crucial. Our heart, obviously, is not a physical organ. It's a center. It's a center with all sorts of important functions. The heart is where love grows, where all the affections are, and according to the Holy Quran, that's where faith ultimately resides. Most of us erroneously think that faith grows on tongue. So we always pay attention to what people say. And as soon as they say something which is outside the orthodox line, we say, these guys are disbelievers. They are all ignorant. They are on the path to hell. Because we think that faith grows on tongue. Rumi would tell us that, no, that's not true. Faith grows in heart. Right? So this all-important center must be watched over. We need to be really careful about what goes inside our heart. If we let something into our heart, it will leave its mark on our heart. This is how affections are created, by things that we allow to come inside our heart. This is how affections are formed. This is how attachments are created. This is how yearnings come into being, when we yearn for something. Now, these yearnings that we have in turn will shape our ideals, our aspirations, and our priorities in life. In a word, we ultimately follow what our hearts desire. So we gotta be very careful what goes inside and find a place in our heart. If you wanna change your behavior, see, philosophers would typically tell you that, let's say you wanna change the behavior of your kids. Let's say your kid is not morally upright. Right? And you ask a philosopher, what should I do? I mean, how can I make my child morally upright? The philosopher would typically tell you that send your child to an ethics class. Because the problem is up here. If you change the way your child thinks, he will behave morally. Rumi would laugh at this notion. He said, no. You are misguided. What you need to change in your kid is what goes on inside your kid's heart. Because ultimately, all actions, ultimately, when at its lowest level, we all follow our yearnings. So if you want to change the behavior of your kid, make sure that you change the yearnings of your kid. That's how aspirations change and how behavior ultimately will change. Here is the critical thing, though. The choices we make in life, the actions we take, open some doors on us, but at the same time, close other doors on us. Are you with me? It's not just that when we make a choice and, you know, take a course of action, only opportunities show up. No. Whatever choice we make in life would also close down some opportunities on you. And the choices come out of what is inside your heart, right? I think one of Rumi's personal experiences is quite illuminating in what I just told you, that our actions and choices open some doors on us and close others on us as well. As you know, Rumi's masterpiece Mathnavi spans 6 volumes. When Rumi finished volume 1 of Mathnavi, it took him a good 2 years to start composing the poems for the second book. Did you know that? For 2 years, no matter how hard he tried, he could not compose any poetry at all. Something happened to Rumi. Something happened to him that basically dried up the fountain of his imagination, the fountain of his creativity. The power which enabled him to compose those divine poems suddenly disappeared. For 2 years, he really, really tried hard to compose poetry. He could not. Why? What happened to Rumi? What led him to this predicament? When the spell was finally gone and he regained his creative imagination and his creative strength, he recalled, "Ey dariqa lughmei do khurde shod. Ey dariqa lughmei do khurde shod. Jooshesh fikrat az an afsurde shod. Oh, 2 mouthfuls were eaten, and thereby the ferment of thought was frozen up." This is the metaphor of 2 mouthfuls were eaten, right? He's basically trying to say the following: I found new interests, new hobbies, new preoccupations, which effectively blocked the flow of inspiring thoughts into my mind and my heart. I made some choices in my life that effectively blocked this flow of inspiring divine ideas, divine inspirations into my heart and my mind. And then he says the following: something really killed off my heart. این لطف دل که از یک مشت گل ماه او چون می شود پروین گسل. Behold the beauty of the heart. Behold the beauty of the heart. How its light is broken and disordered by a single handful of clay. In other words, the heart is so tender. The heart is so fragile that it quickly loses its receptivity to God, its receptivity to divine inspirations. The heart can quickly, can suddenly lose its spirituality, so to speak. Right? If we let pollutants enter into our heart, that's what's going to happen. That's why it is so important to basically have constant attention on what goes on inside our heart. So, now that we know our heart is such an important faculty, and we need to really be vigilant about what goes into our heart, the question is the following: how can we keep our heart healthy and vibrant? How can we keep our heart healthy and vibrant? Rumi has two suggestions for us. The first suggestion, control the access to your heart. Control the pathways to your heart. If you want to keep the pollutants out, make sure that you monitor your heart's intake system. That's a term that mechanics use all the time when I take my car in for repair. Well, believe it or not, your heart also has an intake system. Let me ask you, what is the intake system of our heart? Our five senses. It is through our five senses that our heart receives information from the outside world. We have this famous poem in Farsi, هر آنچه دیده بیند دل کند یاد. هر آنچه دیده بیند دل کند یاد. Whatever the eyes see, the heart will yearn for. Whatever the eyes see, the heart will yearn for. So, control these channels, your five senses, and you will keep your heart clean. And I think I've elaborated enough on it already. Hire these guards and have them watch over your senses. The second mechanism for keeping our heart clean, control your heart's diet. Any cardiologists here today? As cardiologists would tell you, if you want to have a good heart, what should you do? Watch what you eat. Your diet is so important for a well-functioning heart. I'm here to tell you, it is true physiologically and spiritually. The kind of spiritual food you give to your heart will make your heart either healthy or sick. In the Holy Quran, we have the concepts of a healthy heart and a sick heart. Those of you who are familiar with the Quran, you've seen this, right? What does the Quran call a healthy heart? In Arabic, it is called qalb salim, a pure and clean heart. And the Quran informs us that the Prophet Abraham had qalb salim, a pure and peaceful heart. Is ja'a rabbahu biqalbin salim. Behold, Abraham came to his Lord with a pure heart. The Quran also informs us that there is something called a sick heart. Disbelievers all have sick heart. Those who turn their back to truth, those who turn their back to light, they live in darkness. By the way, contrary to what the Taliban and Al-Qaeda teach us, these believers are not Christians, Jews, or Zoroastrians from an Islamic perspective. These believers are people who turn their back to light, to the truth. A lot of Muslims, unfortunately, have turned their backs to the truth in modern life. And the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are the primary examples of disbelievers in modern time. Right? So, when I say disbelievers, don't think of people who are not Muslim in the ordinary sense of the term. Now, the Quran informs us that disbelievers, there is nothing necessarily wrong with their mind. There is something wrong with their heart. فِي قُلُوبِهِمْ مَرَز فِي قُلُوبِهِمْ مَرَز. Their hearts are sick. There is disease in their heart. What does the Quran mean? What does the Quran mean? Well, when we are ill, when we are sick, our body typically shows some symptoms, right? What are the symptoms of flu? We are still in the flu season, right? How does our body manifest its sickness when it has caught the flu virus? Things like a runny nose, fever, coughing. These are symptoms of a sick body. Let me ask you this question. What are the symptoms of a sick heart? How does a sick heart show its ailment? Anybody? Yes?
Being negative.
What?
Negativity.
Okay, that's one of the negativity. Anybody else?
Unhappiness.
Hatred.
Aggression.
What?
Aggression.
Aggression, yes.
Jealousy.
Brutality. Hypocrisy. Arrogance. The mother of all evil. Arrogance. These are symptoms of a sick heart. When a heart is sick, its ailment is revealed in these kind of symptoms. So that's what the Quran means. When somebody turns his or her back to the truth, to light, it's not because their mind doesn't have enough scientific and philosophical information. There is something wrong with their heart. That's where the problem lies. And if you ask Rumi, what sort of food should we give our heart so that it maintains its vibrance, its health? What do you think Rumi would respond? What is the best food, the best diet for the heart?
Faith.
What?
Faith to God.
Okay. What is before that? Muhabbat. Love. Loving kindness. Compassion. This is the best diet for the heart. If you give more of this kind of food to your heart will never be sick. And those symptoms that we all agreed that are symptoms of a sick heart will never appear in your character. All those character flaws will suddenly wither away. Muhabbat, love, compassion, loving kindness, that's the best diet for the heart. A heart that is filled with love will be spiritually and morally healthy. A person who has such a heart, a pure heart, a heart full of love, will be morally upright. Morally upright. Will be closer to God. You want to be closer to God? More prayers would not necessarily do the trick. Going more to church, to your temple and to mosque would not do the trick. Right? That's what Rumi has to teach us. You want to be closer to God? You got to really give, you know, more the food of love to your heart. A heart that is full of love will have more vibrant and lively faith, will receive more light from God, and yes, God will reveal himself more to a person who has a pure heart. This is the core teaching of Rumi when it comes to faith and spirituality. Such a person who has such a heart, will definitely be on solid ground for the spiritual development and progress. Rumi also teaches that love is not only good food for the heart, it is also an alchemist. Do you know what alchemy means? What is alchemy?
Turning copper into gold.
Good. Is that what you wanted to say as well?
Yeah, to take something and make something.
Yes. Right. You see, in the medieval times, there was a belief, a false belief, nonetheless, a belief that there is something called alchemy or kimia in Farsi. That if you add that to copper, it's going to turn into gold. Rumi says, actually, love has exactly the same property. He calls it the alchemy of love. In other words, love has an amazing transformative power. And let me close my lecture with a little bit more on this Rumi's insight, that love is a panacea. It's the remedy for all evils of the heart, for all the illness of the heart. He tells the story of Luqman. Those of you who are familiar with the Holy Quran, chapter 31 of the Quran is titled Luqman, which was a very wise man. Rumi tells us that Luqman was actually a domestic servant. He was very wise, extremely wise, but at the same time he was a domestic servant. Remember, I'm talking about the alchemy of love, the transformative power of love. Rumi tells us that Luqman's master was very fond of him, very fond of Luqman. He truly enjoyed Luqman's company. Luqman was the source of his inspiration, the source of his enlightenment. At the dinner table, the master would never touch the food until Luqman would first have a bite. One day, the master received a melon as a present from a friend. The master cut the melon and, as he was used to doing, he gave the first slice of that melon to Luqman. Luqman ate that piece of melon as if it was pure sugar and honey. With such an appetite, he ate the first, you know, slice of the melon. When the master saw how Luqman reacted, how much he really enjoyed the melon, he cut a second slice and gave it to Luqman. Again, he ate it so fast, and the master said, "Well, this melon must be really, really tasty that Luqman is basically reacting like that." One slice after another. When the master saw how much Luqman enjoyed the melon, from his delight, the master was now craving for a slice of the melon as well. One piece remained. The master said to himself, "I will eat this myself so that I may see what a sweet melon this is." Guess what? The master ate that melon. It was so bitter that he threw up. Can you picture that? The master told Luqman, "How could you possibly eat this bitter melon with such an appetite?" Luqman had a very wise response. گفت من از دست نعمت بخش تو خوردم چندان که از شرمم دوتو شرمم آمد که یکی تلخ از کفت من ننوشم ای تو صاحب معرفت. Absolutely amazing. Luqman said, "From your munificent hand," munificent means gracious hand. Luqman said, "From your munificent hand, I have eaten so much that I am bent double with shame. I was ashamed not to eat one bitter thing from your hand, O you who are possessed of knowledge. All my life, I have eaten sweet stuff from your hand. I was ashamed that once that you gave me a bitter melon, I would refuse receiving it." Is it how we behave in our married life? "Oh honey, what have you done for me lately? Forget about what you did for me yesterday, the day before yesterday, today what you did for me." Rumi said, "Do not ever forget the grace and the graciousness of others, So one day, if out of ignorance, out of not being mindful, they do wrong to you, think of all the good things that your spouse has done for you throughout your life. I was ashamed not to eat one bitter thing from your hand, O you who are possessed of knowledge. More importantly, لذت دست شکر بخشت داشت اندرین به تیخ تلخی که گذاشت. The melon had the enjoyment of your sugar bestowing hand. How could such enjoyment leave bitterness in my mouth? In other words, Luqman told his master that your hand is just like a container of sugar. It had such an effect on the melon. Your sweet, generous hand took the bitterness out of the melon in my mouth. It was pleasant and tasty. I didn't really pay attention to the melon. I paid attention to the hand that offered the melon to me. That is actually... This is basically what Rumi is teaching us. That is the power of love. And then after this, Rumi tell us about his very famous poetry. Those who are familiar with the Farsi language, I am absolutely sure you have heard this poetry. It's about the magic of love. از محبت تلخا شیرین شود، از محبت مسها زرین شود، از محبت دردها صافی شود، از محبت دردها شافی شود، از محبت مرد زنده می کنند، از محبت شاه بنده می کنند. You can't say it any more beautifully and eloquently than this. By love, bitter things become sweet. By love, bitter things become sweet. By love, pieces of copper become golden. By love, the dregs become clear. By love, pains become healing. By love, the dead is made living. By love, the king is made a slave. This is the transformative power of love. See, that's what love does. That is the alchemy of love. A pure heart is full of love. Such a heart is truly home to God. This sort of a heart is the house of the Lord. That is the house of God. God is always present in this heart. God, this type of heart, God is never absent from such a heart. The Prophet Muhammad has so eloquently explained to us the unbelievable capacity of a pure heart. لا يسقني أرضي ولا سمائي وَيَسَقُنِي قَلْبُ عَبْدِيَ الْمُؤْمِنِ. God said to Prophet Muhammad, the heavens and the earth cannot fit me in them, but the pure heart of a faithful can. Rumi has taken this saying of the Prophet Muhammad and composed the following poetry. گفت پیغمبر که حق فرموده است، من نگنجم هیچ در بالا و پست، در زمین و آسمان و عرش نیز من نگنجم، این یقین دان ای عزیز. در دل مؤمن بگنجم ای عجب، گر مرا جویی در آن دلها طلب، گر مرا جویی در آن دلها طلب. The Prophet said that God has said, I am not contained in the jar of high and low. I am not contained in earth or heaven. Know this for certain, O noble one. But I am contained in the true believer's heart. Oh, how wonderful! If you seek me, search in their hearts. You want to find God? Look into the pure heart of a person. That's where God resides. There is a famous Sufi story, I'm sure probably some of you have heard of it, that a guy wanted to go to Mecca for the pilgrimage Hajj. And when he was going towards Mecca in Saudi Arabia, he came across a Sufi master. The Sufi master asked this person, "Where are you going?" He said, "I'm going to Mecca." He said, "Where is Mecca?" He said, "I am going to go visit the house of God." So Muslims actually call Mecca, the holy shrine in Mecca, as the house of the Lord, the house of God. The Sufi master said, "Let me make it very easy for you. You don't need to go all the way to Mecca. God is right here in my heart. So make the 7 rounds around me, and that is your pilgrimage." تا بکردان خانه در آن نرفت و در این خانه به جز آن حی نرفت. God will never reside in a piece of stone. God resides in the pure heart of the faithful. That's where you need to seek God. گر مرا جویی در آن دلها طلب. If you seek me, search in the hearts of the pure people. So all of this, to make a long story short, all this goes to show that the heart is indeed a sacred place. We should guard it very diligently and very carefully. We should not taint our heart with evil intentions. We should not pollute our heart with base desires. We should never allow strangers to God, strangers to the divine, enter our heart. I guess the time is up, and let me close with a couple of concluding remarks. There is a conclusion of this presentation. What did Rumi teach us? In a nutshell, if we are serious about faith, about spiritual development, we must monitor what goes on inside us. We should really pay attention mostly on what goes in our inner life than what goes on around us. We must watch very carefully over our 5 senses, because ultimately that's how yearnings will be created, how priorities will be set in life. If we allow vulgarity into us, into our heart, it will vulgarize our character, our aspirations, and our ideals. Muraqabe, as I explained today, does not mean that we should go to the mosque and the local church more often. Muraqabe doesn't mean that you have to do rituals and religious practices more and more. Muraqabe is a process that you need to integrate into your daily life, monitoring your inner life. If you want your spirit to soar, to fly high, really watch what your eyes see, what your ears hear, and what intentions are entertained in your heart. And as the saying goes, if you want to soar with the eagles, do not party with turkeys. Thank you very much for your attention, and God bless you all.